Let's do it. 1 Samuel chapter 2. Hannah prayed and said, "My heart exalts in the Lord. My strength is exalted in my God. My mouth derides my enemies because I rejoice in my victory. There is no holy one like the Lord, no one besides you. There is no rock like our God. Talk no more so very proudly. Let not arrogance come from your mouth. For the Lord is a God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed. The bows of the mighty are broken, but the feeble gird on strength. Those who were full have hired themselves out for bread, but those who were hungry are fat with spoil. The barren has borne seven, but she who has many children is forlorn. The Lord kills and brings to life. He brings down to Sheol and raises up. The Lord makes poor and makes rich. He brings low, but also exalts. He raises up the poor from the dust. He lifts the needy from the ash heap to make them sit with princes and inherit a seat of honor. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and on them he has set the world. He will guard the feet of his faithful ones, but the wicked shall be cut off in darkness. For not by might does one prevail. The Lord, his adversary, shall be shattered. The Most High will thunder in heaven. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to his king and exalt the power of his anointed." Then Elkanah went home to Ramah, while the boy remained to minister to the Lord in the presence of the priest Eli. Now the sons of Eli were scoundrels. They had no regard for the Lord or for the duties of the priest to the people. When anyone offered sacrifice, the priest's servant would come while the meat was boiling with a three-pronged fork in his hand, and he would thrust it into the pan or kettle or cauldron or pot. All that the fork brought up, the priest would take for himself. This is what they did at Shiloh to all the Israelites who came there. Moreover, before the fat was burned, the priest's servant would come and say to the one who was sacrificing, "Give meat for the priest to roast, for he will not accept boiled meat from you, but only raw." And if the man said to him, "Let them burn the fat first, and then take whatever you wish," he would say, "No, you must give it now. If not, I will take it by force." Thus the sin of the young men was very great in the sight of the Lord, for they treated the offerings of the Lord with contempt. Samuel was ministering before the Lord, a boy wearing a linen ephod. His mother used to make for him a little robe and take it to him each year when she went up with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice. Then Eli would bless Elkanah and his wife and say, "May the Lord repay you with children by this woman for the gift that she made to the Lord," and then they would return to their home. And the Lord took note of Hannah. She conceived and bore three sons and two daughters, and the boy Samuel grew up in the presence of the Lord. Now Eli was very old. He heard all that his sons were doing to all Israel, and how they lay with the women who served at the entrance to the tent of meeting. He said to them, "Why do you do such things? For I hear of your evil dealings from all these people. No, my sons, it is not a good report that I hear the people of the Lord spreading abroad. If one person sins against another, someone can intercede for the sinner with the Lord. But if someone sins against the Lord, who can make intercession?" But they would not listen to the voice of their father, for it was the will of the Lord to kill them. Now the boy Samuel continued to grow, both in stature and in favor with the Lord and with the people. A man of God came to Eli and said to him, "Thus the Lord has said, I revealed myself to the family of your ancestor in Egypt when they were slaves to the house of Pharaoh. I chose him out of all the tribes of Israel to be my priest, to go up to my altar, to offer incense, to wear an ephod before me. And I gave to the family of your ancestor all my offerings by fire from the people of Israel. Why then look with greedy eye at my sacrifices and my offerings that I commanded, and honor your sons more than me by fattening yourselves on the choicest parts of every offering of my people Israel? Therefore the Lord, the God of Israel, declares, I promise that your family and the family of your ancestor should go in and out before me forever. But now the Lord declares, far be it from me. For those who honor me, I will honor, and those who despise me, shall be treated with contempt. See, a time is coming when I will cut off your strength and the strength of your ancestors' family, so that no one in your family will live to old age. Then in distress you will look with greedy eye on all the prosperity that shall be bestowed upon Israel, and no one in your family shall ever live to old age. The only one of you whom I shall not cut off from my altar shall be spared to weep out his eyes and grieve his heart. All the members of your household shall die by the sword. The fate of your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, shall be the sign to you. Both of them shall die on the same day. I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who shall do according to what is in my heart and in my mind. I will build him a sure house, and he shall go in and out before my anointed forever. Everyone who is left in your family shall come to implore him for a piece of silver or a loaf of bread, and shall say, "Please, put me in one of the priest's places that I may eat a morsel of bread." The word of the Lord.
Michael?
Yes?
King Beckwith didn't want to interrupt you. Mm-hmm. They are working on the boiler now, and they have to come in here and drain all the radiators.
That's cool.
So they were asked if we could move in the church.
He wants to go into the church? Okay. Well, let's do that then. If I can figure out how to pause this. Does anybody have any idea how to pause this thing? There's no pause button on this, Kieran's. Okay. So, this is the Song of Hannah, and as I mentioned last week, the Song of Mary in the Gospel of Luke is very similar to this. In fact, I'm confident that she had this in mind as she offered her thanksgiving to God that she would bear this remarkable child. And the song serves two different purposes. One is a thanksgiving to God for giving her a child. She had been barren, and in the ancient world, women who couldn't bear children were considered to be cursed by God. In the order of creation, as we see in Genesis, humanity was meant to be fruitful and multiply. And a woman's primary role in those societies was to bear children. So if you couldn't do that, you really couldn't fulfill yourself as a woman. That was the perception. And you couldn't contribute toward the following of God's commandment to be fruitful and multiply. And of course, we already talked last week about how, despite that, her husband Elkanah was good to her. This stirred a great deal of resentment and jealousy in his second wife, Peninnah. And so really, the opening verses of the Song of Hannah is a song of both celebration but also vindication. You can see this in verse 1b and 3a. And in case you're not familiar, verses can be segmented into different parts. Where there is a period, there are sub-verses. So verse 1b starts, "My mouth derides my enemies because I rejoice in my victory." I wonder who she might have been thinking of there. And then in verse 3a, "Talk no more so very proudly. Let not arrogance come from your mouth." I have no idea who she might be talking about there, but it could be her co-wife, Peninnah. But as the song goes on, it becomes less personal. And this is the second purpose that the song serves. This is really about Israel's future. Because her son Samuel isn't just any son. He's a very special son who's going to play a major role in bringing Israel together and providing it with prosperity and power. This is a wonderful excursus about God's sovereignty and his ability to reverse the status quo. Things need not be as they are always. And God will provide justice to human relationships. He will restore balance. And Walter Brueggemann, one of the commentaries that I'm consulting as I prepare for this, has a wonderful quotation. "This song provides an interpretive key for the book of Samuel, that is, the power and willingness of Yahweh to intrude, intervene, and invert
is the main theme of this narrative. We watch while the despised ones, Israel, David, become the great ones. At the center of this startling aversion is the eighth son, that's referring to David, and you can read about that in chapter 16, verses 11 through 12, who sits with princes and inherits a seat of honor. So, in a way, this is looking forward to the establishment of the monarchy. Of course, there's a great deal of ambivalence in both Samuel and Kings about whether having kings for Israel is actually a good idea. The people want it, as we discussed a few weeks ago in the opening chapters of 1 Kings, before we decided to come back to Samuel first. And, you know, God said, this is a bad idea, but if this is what they really want, then, you know, we'll give it to them. It reminds me of the quote, I can't remember who gave it, early 20th century. And the quote was, democracy is the idea that people know what they want and deserve to get it good and hard. So you could apply that to the monarchy in ancient Israel. So even as this looks forward to the establishment of the monarchy, it emphasizes God's total sovereignty over all creation. And if you look at verse 8, the final portion, which would be verse 8c, for the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and on them he has set the world. And he has the power to give life, as he did to Samuel through Hannah, but he also has the power to take it, to bring down to Sheol. And there wasn't a highly developed concept of the afterlife in ancient Hebraic thought. And Sheol's not heaven, it's not hell. It's kind of an in-between place, something that we might call limbo or purgatory. It's kind of a shadowy realm of judgment, and it's not horrific, but it's not blissful either. And this assertion of God's authority very early on in this narrative is important, because as we'll see as we get further and further into Samuel and then Kings, the monarchs in their sinful corruption will in fact idolatrously and presumptuously and arrogantly appropriate to themselves authority that belongs to God alone, and that ends up being the big problem. The kings introduce into the nation this idolatry and injustice that ends up permeating it and creating a breach of covenant that can only be resolved through the people's punishment by conquest and exile. Once the song's over, Hannah and her family leave Shiloh, leaving Samuel behind to serve in God's tabernacle. And he's described as a minister of the Lord in verse 11, which indicates that he had a sacerdotal role, a priestly role. And it's odd because Samuel ends up being a prophet. But at least in his early days, he's serving in a priestly role. And I think that one of the reasons that he's portrayed in this way is it provides a contrast between his innocence and his faithfulness and the incredible wickedness and cynicism and selfishness of Eli's sons Phinehas and Hophni. We begin to get the chronicle of this in verse 12, where we're shown how they are violating their office. It was normal for priests to receive a portion of the sacrifices that were made in the tabernacle and then later on in the temple in Jerusalem. That's how they made their living. And the Torah, in two places, specifies which part of the animal sacrifices they can claim as their own. There's not a consistent witness in Deuteronomy chapter 18, verse 3, and this citation is in your notes. It says the priests get the shoulder, the jowls, and the stomach. I would have passed on the jowls and the stomach, personally, but, you know, to each their own. And Leviticus chapter 7, verses 28 through 35 lists the right thigh and the breast, and I'm all good with that. This business of dredging the pot with this three-pronged fork, and basically whatever comes up is what the priest gets, that's not a practice that we see in the Torah. That doesn't mean that it was necessarily wrong. In fact, this practice of sort of dipping in and you know, whatever comes up is yours, I mean, maybe that's a way of including divine providence in this process of what the priest will receive from the sacrifice. But within the context, this is implicitly criticized as part of a greater whole of corruption. In verse 14, it mentions the pan or kettle or cauldron or pot. We don't really know what these various vessels were all about. So that is what it is. We have no idea what that's all about. But not only that, they were extorting people, and they were basically saying, before we sacrifice this, we want raw meat, because we don't like it boiled the way the English do it. Sorry, Peter. We want to roast it instead. But that's not how it worked, because you would sacrifice the animal, and God always got the first fruits, including the blood, which would be splashed on the altar. God also got the fat from the sacrifice. That would be burned on the altar or on the incense stand. They didn't have the really cool gunpowder-infused charcoal briquettes that we use to get our incense going, and so they would set the fat on fire and then put the incense on top of the fat, and that's how they would actuate the incense. Okay, so the blood and the fat belonged to God. If they got the raw meat first, that meant they were depriving God of some of the blood and some of the fat. And what's even worse is they didn't squeeze these people themselves. They sent out a servant to do it. I mean, they wouldn't even do their own dirty work. So selfish and cowardly all at once. And so they're undermining the whole purpose of the sacrifice. You see these requirements about the blood and the fat enshrined in Torah in Leviticus 17:6 and Numbers 18:17. So we get a clear understanding of how badly Phinehas and Hophni are abusing their office as priests. And then, sort of abruptly, there's a brief mention of Samuel again in verse 18. Every year he gets to reunite with mom and dad as they come up to make their annual sacrifice. Mom's putting together these linen ephods for him. This is a garment described in Exodus as a priestly garment to be worn when the duties of office are being exercised. And again, emphasizing his priestly role in the tabernacle and the contrast between him and Eli's sons. While there, Eli blesses Elkanah and Hannah, his blessing is fulfilled by God. Hannah ends up having three more sons and two more daughters. And then in verse 22, we switch back to Eli and his sons. He hears about what they're doing, and he understands that it's wrong. In addition to all the other stuff they're doing at the sacrifices, they're bedding the women who are serving at the entrance to the tent of meeting. And he's like, you've got to stop this. It's one thing for you to sin against these people that you're essentially stealing from, because you can always intercede with God and receive forgiveness and the people can be reconciled. But what you're doing with the sacrifices is an offense against God. And how can you intercede with God when your offense is against Him? And I think the thought behind this was because the priest did intercede with God for the offenses the people had committed against God. These were the sacrifices of atonement. But what's behind this is Eli's basically saying, how, since you have undermined the legitimacy of your priesthood and therefore can't really offer valid sacrifices, how can you sacrifice to God for atonement after everything that you've done to corrupt your relationship with Him? But they ignore him, and the reason given is, for it was the will of the Lord to kill them. And we've seen this before, where the first thing that comes to mind is Exodus and God hardening Pharaoh's heart. I mean, Pharaoh's heart was hardened in part because he was just a cruel and arrogant man. But as you'll recall, the liberation of the Hebrew people, that was almost a secondary motive for what God was doing. His principal motive was to show forth His glory in all the world and to convince Pharaoh that He was the only one true God. And so here, Phinehas and Hophni deserve to die, and they need to, in order for God's purposes to be accomplished. And when we hear the oracle from God in the last third of the chapter, we'll understand more fully why that is. So in a way, he prevents them from repenting because he needs them to keep on sinning in order for his will to be actualized much further down the line. And of course, this is always a difficult thing to countenance, because one would think that God wants us to be in right relationship with him, and at least give us the chance to get square with him. But, you know, sometimes our remaining in sin, and especially if you think back to our class on Romans, where Paul sort of explains the role of Torah in particular as accentuating rather than remedying sin, so that people could get ready for Jesus as Messiah. This is just one of the ways in which the divine sovereignty has worked out. Then again, a very brief reference to Samuel in verse 26. So you see the back and forth that's going on here, okay? They keep interspersing little mentions of Samuel in between the broader narrative of Eli's sons as a way to compare and contrast, okay? And then in 27, a man of God, unidentified, comes to share an oracle with Eli. He starts by briefly recounting God's saving work in Egypt. I chose him out of all the tribes of Israel to be my priest, to go up to my altar. That refers to Moses, not Aaron. The Eliite priesthood had its roots in Moses. They were descendants of Moses. There is a different line of priesthood called the Aaronic priesthood from Aaron, Moses' sidekick. And we're going to get into that a little bit later in the chapter. What you have starting in verse 29 is basically a recounting of what we've already heard in terms of the wrongdoing that Eli's sons are engaged in. And God's anger is revealed in verse 30, where he says, I promise that your family and the family of your ancestors should go in and out before me forever. And it's very, very rare for God to go back on a forever promise. But here he does. Far be it from me. For those who honor me, I will honor, and those who despise me shall be treated with contempt. In other words, your violation of this covenant, this special covenant I have with your household, you've done such a bad job that I've decided in this case that I'm not going to hold up my end of the bargain. And basically then what you see is that a prophecy that the Eliite priesthood will be destroyed. You find that later on, actually in 1 Kings that we were studying just a couple of weeks ago, where at Solomon's ascension, David had two high priests. He had Zadok and he had Abiathar. And the eldest surviving son of Solomon assumed that he would inherit the throne. He was mistaken. Nathan and Bathsheba conspired to plant a false memory in David's mind. Remember, you said that Solomon would take the throne, and he decreed that Solomon should be king, and Solomon accedes to the throne, and the people who backed the wrong horse, Adonijah, they lose out. And Abiathar was the high priest who sided with Adonijah. And Abiathar is the last surviving remnant of the Eliite priesthood. Okay? So the one of you whom I shall not cut off from my altar shall be spared to weep out his eyes and grieve his heart. That's Abiathar. Okay? And the death of Hophni and Phinehas, who will die on the same day, that's, if you will, the first fruits of God's wrath. And then later on, the majority of the Eliite priesthood will be killed by King Saul in 1 Samuel chapter 22, verses 11 through 23. And we'll get to that in 5 months. And so Abiathar is not killed, but he's exiled. So he is left to mourn his loss and the loss of his ancestral rights to the priesthood. And Zadok, who is a descendant of Aaron and part of the Aaronic line of the priesthood, then takes over. So it's going to take a long while for this oracle, this prophecy, to be fulfilled. But Eli is going to see the first part of it horribly in losing his two sons. In verse 35, it says, I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who shall do according to what is in my heart and in my mind. You know, since Samuel is currently serving in a priestly role, we might immediately think, okay, that must be Samuel. But it's not. He's referring to Zadok here. Because Samuel's role, as we'll see as we get further into 1 Samuel, is to serve as a prophet, as sort of a counterpart of the monarchy, but also the person who actually institutes it through God's command. And finally, in the verse 36, the Eliite priesthood will be reduced essentially to begging. So their degradation will be complete. It starts off happy with the song of Hannah. Wondrous things have happened. She's finally vindicated. Screw you, Peniah. God's come to save me. It broadens out to the fact that this is more than just something personal. This is a historic moment where the implications of Samuel's birth will create a restoration of justice. And then you have this connection between God reversing the current order and establishing balance and justice. You see that being played out in the wickedness of Eli's sons and the fact that God's basically eventually going to shift the priesthood from one branch to another, from the descendants of Moses to the descendants of Aaron. So, what you got? John.
Is there anything you can share with us about Samuel rather than being a prophet and son of Hannah? What is his importance that you see?
Well, you know, we're going to spend some time with that, and next week when we work on chapter 3, which is a hilarious chapter, we're going to begin to see Samuel's importance. Eli's really beginning to fade. He can't see very well. And Samuel's sleeping in the temple. But remember, the temple hasn't been built yet, so temple equals tabernacle or tent of meeting. And God calls out to him, Samuel, Samuel, and Samuel goes to Eli, and he says, what do you want? And Eli's like, what do you mean, what do I want? He says, well, you called me. No, I didn't call you. You know, get out of here, I'm going back to sleep. And, you know, and then it happens again. And then Eli says, look, this is probably God, because it's definitely not me. So the next time it happens, you know, just acknowledge God's presence and listen. And starting in verse 11, it says, see, I am about to do something in Israel that will make both ears of anyone hears it tingle. I love that. It goes back to talking about the punishment of Eli's sons. It really in his first prophetic act, Samuel relays this vision, this oracle from God. Eli wants to know what God told him, and Samuel tells him everything. And Eli actually handles it pretty well. It is the Lord. Let him do what seems good to him. Samuel, from that point forward, was honored as a trustworthy prophet of the Lord. God continued to appear to Samuel at Shiloh. And then in chapter 4, which I mentioned last week as we were doing the introduction and kind of looking at the broad overview of 1 Samuel, Samuel disappears for a while. And we get these three chapters focusing on the ark. And you really, to understand what appears to be a sort of disjuncted drop-in about the Ark of the Covenant for the better part of three chapters, you have to have an appreciation of the broader narrative. And Samuel comes back in chapter 7 and really begins his prophetic mission telling people to get rid of their idols, Astartes. You have the situation with the Philistines and all that. And as Samuel ages, he puts his sons in positions as judges, kind of a flashback to the preceding book. This establishes a line that will continue. And in chapter 8, verse 10, Samuel begins to tell people there's going to be a king. And you think you want it, but you're not going to like it. These will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots and to be his horsemen and to run before his chariots. And he will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties and some to plow his ground and to reap his harvest and on and on and on and on and on. You know, beware what you wish for kind of stuff. And then Samuel basically, with the consent of God, anoints Saul to be the king among the people. And then Samuel sort of serves as a companion, but also as a challenger to Saul, an attempt to help him serve as a proper kingship. But it doesn't work out so well. You get to chapter 11, verse 12. The people said to Samuel, "Who is it that said, 'Shall Saul reign over us?' Give them to us so that we may put them to death." But Saul said, "No one shall be put to death this day, for today the Lord has brought deliverance to Israel." Samuel said to the people, "Come, let us go up to Gilgal, and they'll there renew the kingship." So there they go. And eventually, Samuel's going to be the one who IDs David as the person who's going to take over from Saul. Okay? So he plays a big role as basically a channel of God's truth and will to the people, and is really shaping the emergence of the monarchy. Yeah. Yeah, Peter. Yeah, that's unusual. And we're not really sure. I mean, it's possible, I suppose, that Elkanah had, these tribes were not exclusive. There was a measure of intermingling, you know, so maybe somewhere in the family tree there was somebody, you know, from the house of Levi or from the house of Aaron. But it seems that he was brought in by adoption. And he wouldn't have been a fully fledged priest, especially not at that age. He would have kind of been a helper. I mean, that seems to have been his role. He was kind of a helper of sorts. But it's not unprecedented for a prophet to have first been a priest. And the juxtaposition of those two roles, which often are opposed because the prophets tend to be very critical of the priesthood and the monarchy, two things that were sewn very closely together in the Old Testament. The idea that a few of the prophets were actually priests only accentuates their authority to serve as oracles of God to rail against the corrupt priesthood. So, Judy.
You said last week, I think it was, that we're seeing the change from the judges and the priesthood to the kings and the prophets.
Yes. Correct.
Who is trying to keep the kings in check.
Yeah. It's almost as if the prophets were provided as a way to temper the monarchy, which the people wanted but God thought was not a good idea. It was only inevitable that, you know, sinful human beings would end up appropriating authority that rightfully belongs to God alone. And in some ways, though, the kingship served God's purposes. It it brought together these 12 tribes, which were sort of loosely confederated, and united them in a way that took them beyond the time of the judges and enabled them to be powerful and prosperous. And, of course, that enabled them to serve as a stronger symbol of God's glory. But it just spun out of control. And the prophets, despite their best efforts, were not able to contain the idolatry and the injustice that gradually insinuated itself into the royal household and the people at large. So this was a doomed project from the beginning, the kingship. And the prophets were there to temper, to warn, to provide ways of repentance. They were sometimes heeded, but increasingly as time went by, ignored. And the duality of king and prophet, again, was to demonstrate God's purposes being worked out despite human sinfulness, despite the chosen people forsaking the covenant, and the horrible consequences that that brought. All of this was intended to keep the voice of the Lord alive through the prophets, even as the monarchy spiraled totally out of control, so that there would be a clear sense that God would get what he wanted despite it all. So that's why you kind of have them in tandem.
Checks and balances.
Checks and balances, yeah, something like that. Go ahead. Oh, yeah, I mean, it's exceptionally similar. In fact, why don't you just stay on 1 Samuel 2 and then sort of keep an eye on that while I read the Magnificat. From, hang on a second. Okay, I got the song. Yeah, it's Luke 1, verse 46. So you're looking at Song of Hannah, so here comes Song of Mary. My soul magnifies the Lord, and my spirit rejoices in God my Savior, for he has looked with favor on the lowliness of his servant. Surely from now on all generations will call me blessed, for the Mighty One has done great things for me, and holy is his name. His mercy is for those who fear him from generation to generation. He has shown strength with his arm. He has scattered the proud in the thoughts of their hearts. He has brought down the powerful from their thrones and lifted up the lowly. He has filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich away empty. He has helped his servant Israel in remembrance of his mercy, according to the promise he made to our ancestors, to Abraham and to his descendants forever. I mean, it's shorter than the Song of Hannah, but it even has the same structure. The opening verses start out personal. Okay, she's giving thanks to God for the way that God has blessed her. But then in verse 30 of Luke chapter 1, she begins to shift to a much broader focus, where this isn't just about her. The implications about what's happening through her and for her will involve the entire world. And an utter reversal, where those who suffer, those who hunger, those who are regarded and derided as weak, they will be exalted and elevated by God. You know, I mean, it brings to mind a pithier expression from Jesus. Those who are humble will be exalted, and those who are exalted will be humbled. You know, and again, this attests to the sovereignty of God, God's willingness to intervene, God's power to change the entire social order, to exert justice in unjust situations. And it's also a reminder that none can be proud before God. You know, it's very easy when a person is prospering, they're in a position of power, to attribute that not to God's blessing, but to their own merit. And for those who are forgetful of that, they place themselves in great danger. Because when you divorce the boon from the source, it's sort of like damming up a river. It's going to dry out eventually. And, you know, this remains our godly hope that, you know, God will restore a balance. You know, Jesus talks about, he goes to his hometown synagogue in Nazareth. I think we had this story in the lectionary cycle not long ago. And he is given the scroll of Isaiah, and he turns to a place and he talks about the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. What is the year of the Lord's favor? The year of the Lord's favor is the Jubilee. Okay? The year of the Jubilee. And we have no record that this was actually practiced for pretty obvious reasons. But as a way to provide some measure of equity, on the 50th year, every 50 years, it was meant to be a Jubilee year. And this is a year when the fields would lay fallow and when debts would be erased and property that had changed hands would be restored to their original owners, and people who during that 50-year period of time had been enslaved would be set free. This essentially was God's ultimate remedy to rampant social injustice, the oppression of the poor. So it's intriguing that, you know, literalists who embrace certain portions of Torah never mention the year of Jubilee. And none of us do, because it's impractical and it would be incredibly disruptive. Most importantly, it would intrude upon the benefits of some. And that's very much what Hannah and Mary and Isaiah are referring to. There'd be complete and utter chaos and confusion. Even if not practiced, it still serves as a very powerful symbol of God's intention for how we are meant to handle our economic life.
The other way to get community ministries to strive to help the underprivileged and the oppressed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They try to bring that to them and not disenfranchise people who perhaps have prospered during that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, Caroline.
Didn't Pope Francis, or maybe his previous Pope, declare a special year of some kind? Is that related to
it? Loosely, Pope Francis declared a Jubilee. In fact, there's actually a special door at St. Peter's in Rome. It was a symbol of a year of grace, and these have been declared periodically by the Roman Catholic Church for various reasons, it usually has to do with how do I put it?
Returning to prodigals.
Yeah, returning the prodigals is really the best way to say it. I mean, it's... No, they don't forgive debts, but one of the things they do is, I suppose, they approach sin and penitence and forgiveness more leniently, I guess is the best way that I can put it. It's a year of Jubilee in the Roman Catholic Church is sort of a, you know, turning the spigot of grace all the way on kind of thing, where certain exceptions are made in terms of, you know, one of the things that I seem to remember, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that there was sort of special dispensation for people who had had abortions to receive absolution.
Divorce.
Yeah, I'm sure divorce was in there. No, you still can't remarry. Anybody got the time? I don't want us to run over. I want to respect your time. Quarter till. Okay, so we got plenty of time. Yeah, David.
I think it's interesting that in this case, Anna, mm-hmm. and before her, Sarah, in the New Testament, Elizabeth, mm-hmm. God takes a class of people who aren't rated right now, women.
Yes.
In their older age, considered barren, so they're probably even lower on the totem pole than most of them.
Yeah.
And from each of those three brings a son who has a dramatic impact on the community.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you see this persistently in the Old Testament. In a way, it's an embodiment of the types of things you find in the Song of Hannah, where you had the practice of primogeniture, where the oldest son is meant to be the heir. Okay? Well, the oldest son of Abraham was not Isaac, but nevertheless, he was the inheritor, and Hagar and Ishmael were cast out because of Sarah's jealousy. Sarah and Abraham were much too old to have children, but they had one anyway. And then Isaac had a couple of kids, Jacob and Esau, and they were twins, but Esau managed to pop out of the womb a few seconds before Jacob, and so he would have rightfully received the inheritance of Isaac's blessing. In collusion with his mom, Jacob deceives his aging, ailing father into conferring the blessing on him instead. And then Jacob runs off because Esau's going to kill him. And he ends up having a bunch of children. And does he favor the eldest? No, he doesn't. He favors Joseph instead, you know, which creates, you know, it just... on and on and on and on and on. And so God brings life where there is apparently lifelessness by enabling these otherwise barren women to give birth to very special children who play a major role in God's life, in God's life with us. And as we'll see as we get farther along into Samuel, the one chosen to succeed Saul as king, David, he's the eighth son. And his dad doesn't even bother presenting him to the prophet. He leaves him out in the fields to tend the sheep because he's so far down the pecking order, why even bother? But David was the one that was chosen. And of course, as we saw a few weeks ago, as we were just getting into 1 Kings, Adonijah had the rightful claim, but it was Solomon, a younger son, who, I mean, and it just, God doesn't play by our rules. He doesn't care much for our social norms. And you see this message persistently woven throughout Hebrew Scripture, that God's going to work out his purposes in ways that contradict the expectations and customs of people. And we have to be aware of that, that human privilege is absolutely meaningless to God. Absolutely meaningless. Yeah, Peter.
The kosher meat is still bled.
Right, yeah.
I'm not Jewish custom, but is a lot of it boiled, like it's described?
No, as long as you bleed it out, you can prepare it however you want. So,
I can't imagine the steak that's being bled out.
Yeah, you're never going to completely bleed it out. The idea is you get out all that you can. And the violation that Phineas and Hophni were committing by demanding raw meat wasn't that they were asking for meat that wasn't kosher. Okay, they were just asking for... They were basically butting in ahead of God. They were basically breaking in line is what they were doing, because it had to be sacrificed first. Then it had to be prepared for consumption properly, which roasting a raw meat would be able to do, but this would have been pre-sacrifice. So I suppose there is some question as to whether it would have been entirely kosher or not. I've had kosher meat, and it's just like, it's like no worse than any other meat. It's just it's prepared in a very specific way to ensure that you can get out what you can, because one, you have the association with the blood being poured on the altar of God, and the reason being is that blood is the essence of life. To consume the essence of life, we don't have the right to do that.
I'm thinking about the big problem for sticking in the top. You're going to come up with the biggest pieces,
I think. It's kind of a lottery, I guess. The sort of image I have is this guy's got this three-pronged fork, and he's sort of digging around and, poking around and, instead of sort of stabbing, he's just sort of like, using it as a lever, to drag up all he can get. This is just sheer greed. And they were well provided for. They just, I suppose, had an insatiable appetite. And they were robbing God. They were robbing people making their holy sacrifices to God. And this is just about as bad as you could get. How will we do this? Just imagine if you can that Reverend Shelley or I are at the altar and we're consecrating the bread and the wine, and when we're finished, we eat most of it. And basically, whoever gets to the altar rail first gets whatever's left. And, most of you, come up here and we're just sort of like, sorry, we're out. Better luck next week. Sit up front. This is basically what was happening. They were defiling the sacrifice. Oh yeah, theft is theft, and if we're all tapped out, that's cool. Some days will keep you late, so we'll balance it out. God wants things balanced out. So why don't we say the Lord's Prayer together? Next week we'll jump into chapter 3, which is a lot of fun.